Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm your host, journalist Holly Rubinstein, and here each week I'll be speaking to a very special guest about the seven chapters in their life's travel diaries. From their earliest childhood travel memory and the first place they fell in love with, to their hidden gem and what's at the top of their travel bucket list, we'll be uncovering their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. Well, I hope that you're keeping safe and well this week. I think it's really beginning to feel quite festive, isn't it? I certainly felt the Christmassy feeling when I was up in the Lake District earlier this week. I was there for a few days in Cumbria. We stayed near to Lake Windermere, which is the biggest of the lakes in the Lake District. And I mean, I'd heard so much about the Lake District, and we talk about it on episode one with Stanley Tucci because he filmed a film up there and he was telling me how amazing it is. I'd been there when I was little, but I couldn't really remember it. And just taking the car ferry across the lake and exploring the majestic landscapes, some of the best roads we've ever driven, the vistas of the mountains were just amazing. Ambleside, Coniston Water, that kind of area is where we were, and it was a perfect place for a long weekend. And if you're based in London, we found it really easy to get to on the train, and then we hired a car, upgrading to an automatic. Best decision that we probably made that weekend. Those roads are quite hair-raising, but you know, that's so you can get those amazing views, right? And then we were able to go back to a real sanctuary after a day's exploring. The Gilpin Hotel and Spa, who I'm writing an article about, it was just the most beautiful hotel. We stayed in one of their spa suites based in the grounds of the hotel. And what really sets them apart is they have their own spa treatment room with a sauna, a steam room, a Japanese massage chair, as well as an outside hot tub and a wild swimming pond. So I really, really felt that it was a restorative place to be based after a day out walking in the chilly winds of the Lake District. One downside is that you can't see Lake Windermere from there, but it is in a really beautiful rural setting, so that kind of makes up for it. And it has two restaurants. One is Michelin starred, actually, but we actually enjoyed its more relaxed restaurant, Spice. It will without question be added to my list of favorite meals I've had. Great atmosphere, these incredible Asian fusion inspired small plates. And if you're in the area, not necessarily staying at the hotel, but if you're in the area, book a seat at the chef's table there. It's a great experience. And a couple of other things before we get started. If you'd like to read more about my travel memories and recommendations, I was interviewed this week by Sheer Lux, one of my favorite online magazines, for their My Life in Travel feature, and I filled it jam-packed with all my recommendations, so do check that out. And as we're in the run-up to Christmas, less than a month ago, the last couple of weeks, I'm publishing Christmas gift guides on my Instagram at Holly Rubinstein. So if you're looking for inspiration, for in particular for travel lovers, for gift ideas, then have a scroll and let me know what you think. Okay, on to today's guest. Today I'm joined by the much-loved comedian, musician and actor Bill Bailey. Known for his hugely inventive stand-up, he's of course such a familiar face on our TV screens too, spending several years as team captain on the long-running music and comedy panel show Nevermind the Buzzcocks, making regular appearances on shows like QI and Have I Got News for You, and most recently being crowned the champion of Strictly Come Dancing with partner Oti Mabuse last year. Bill kicks off his travel diaries having just returned from an incredible sounding trip to Iceland, so he tells us all about that. He shares his love of Indonesia, where he spontaneously eloped with his wife many years ago and they travel back most years. As a gigging comedian, he has discovered every corner of the UK, so he reveals some British hidden gems that could be on your doorstep. And he shares his tips for Strictly this year he's been tuning into. Bill joins me from his West London family home, which he shares with a menagerie of pets, including 5 rescue dogs, a cat, a parrot, a snake, ducks, and hens, which you will occasionally hear laying an egg in the background. This is a really fun one, so let's get started. Bill Bailey, welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. So exciting. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Yeah.
It looks like you're just back from a pretty epic looking trip to Iceland, was it?
Yes, That's right. It was wonderful. I've been to Iceland a few times performing, and also I went there for a week with my son a few years ago, and we did a lot of activities around Reykjavik. We went we descended into the cone of an extinct volcano. That was pretty amazing.
Oh wow! Yeah.
And you sort of see all the the interior of it and the magma chamber and all that was amazing. And then we went snorkeling in a glacial fissure, which I've got to say was quite not for the faint-hearted, put it that way. It was quite cold, a little bit nippy.
Yeah. Were so you wearing full body wetsuits?
Well, we were actually wearing dry suits. So you can wear your own clothes underneath because they, as the name suggests, you stay dry. And there's a sort of waterproof seal at the neck, at the wrists. So you can wear jeans and thermals and all the rest of it. So the only disadvantage of that, of course, is quite bulky and you tend to sort of, clump along in a rather ungainly manner. But in the water, of course, you're afforded a lot of warmth and protection. I mean, the water's like 1 degree, 2 degrees. But the view is unbelievable. This crystal clear water. You get about 100 meters of visibility. And it's on the line of two tectonic plates. So it's quite a sort of an amazing, surreal landscape anyway. But
is there marine life that you're spotting while you're there? Or is it more about just like the magnitude of the geology?
Yes, it's very much that. Yes, there's not really much in the way of wildlife. Not much can survive in that. But what you get is this sense of surreal wonder at the fact that you are suspended in this beautiful, clear, crystal clear blue water, which you can see in every direction. And there's a kind of sense of weightlessness. If you dive down, it looks like you're just floating. It's in air. You're not aware of the water. It's almost like you're flying through it. It's amazing. It's unlike anywhere I've ever been. But that was good fun. But this latest time we went up north to Akureyri with the second city, and which is quite different, much more sort of mountainous, and there's glaciers and lakes and such like. It's a beautiful country. I love it.
Yeah, it is a beautiful country, and really like nowhere else on the planet.
No, that's right. It is. It's kind of unique, really, in all the places I've been. The people are very friendly. It's almost like tourism there is starting to kind of, it's still quite new, really, in terms of the, in the global tourism trade. It's still, there's lots of new operations are being sort of set up, and you can go husky sledding, which is what we did. You can go and see the Northern Lights. There's an amazing place, the Bubble Hotel, which we went to, which was just literally, the rooms are just inflatable clear plastic bubbles.
That's so cool. I think I've seen those on Instagram, and so you just have this uninterrupted view of the sky.
Yeah, exactly. So the idea is, you lie down on the bed and you just look up at the night sky and you see the stars and the Northern Lights.
Did you see the Northern Lights? Were you able to see it this time?
We did, yes. Oh, yes,
amazing.
We did.
That's so
cool. It was pretty cool. I've seen them a few times in different places, Norway and up in the north of Scotland, actually.
Really?
But they turned up. One, in fact, when we were near the Bubble Hotel, we sort of like, one of the guides, our Icelandic guides, just sort of casually said, oh, yeah, the Northern Lights are, they're so sort of so blasé because they sort of see them all the time. They go, yeah, the Northern Lights are up. We were like, wow, we were all kind of going crazy of it. And the thing was, when we were there, the moon was so bright. When you're taking pictures, because of course you need a long exposure to take the Northern Lights, you need like a sort of 7-8 exposure. The moonlight was sort of bleached into all these photographs as well. So it looks like the Northern Lights are happening in the day. I looked at these photographs, it's the most surreal sight. So
I saw the Northern Lights in Iceland as well. It's the only place I've seen them. And I remember that we went, we were kind of obsessed. Like, if you're going there with that in mind, we were looking at the app, that tells you if it's going to be a good day or a bad day. going out in our pajamas, like spontaneously at 1 a.m. on the off chance that they might appear. And then on the very last night, they started dancing across the sky. I don't think quite as epic as they look, it looks in the photos. But I think if you take it with a long exposure, it actually does also kind of exaggerate what it is that you're seeing as well. But it is just something, like, it's such a bucket list experience, isn't it?
Oh, totally. Yeah, it really is. It's something which you are struck by the sense of this, almost this magnificent display of nature, which is just happening regardless of whether you're there or not. It's just this phenomenon that you are, and you're, it's quite humbling in many ways. And it's so awe-inspiring. It's like the most beautiful light display that you've ever seen. And yet it just happens there for, as part of a natural phenomenon. But yeah, you're right. If you take a picture of it, you can see that the way that the kind of, you can see it more of as a wind.
Yes.
And, you know, if you look at it and it's just there in the sky, you're not quite aware of the fact that it's moving. But when you take a series of pictures, then you get the sense of it flows. You know, it looks like a banner that's sort of fluttering in the wind.
Totally, totally. And really what I realized is that I didn't need to take the photo, that I just needed to be present in the moment and enjoy it for what it was. Yeah.
Definitely, yeah.
So we are going to go then on a journey through the 7 chapters of your life's travel diaries, Bill.
Yes.
We're going to start first at the very beginning. Chapter 1 is your earliest childhood travel memory.
Yes. Well, this would be, most probably would be Weston-super-Mare, because I remember going there as a child with my family, and this was the kind of our nearest go-to beach. And so, you know, it was a family day out. We would get in the car, the whole family, me, my mum, my dad, and there would be my grandparents as well would come with us. And so we would all pile into this car and we would drive to Weston-super-Mare because that was the beach. That was the nearest beach. And
and it's a beautiful beach, isn't it?
It is. It's amazing. It's a huge, vast expanse of sand, which as a kid, obviously, is just is brilliant. You know, you just run around, you kick a ball, you can dig sandcastles. It just goes on and on and on forever. And there, at the time when I was going, there was a pier. I mean, it's classic sort of British seaside resort. There's a pier. You can get candy floss. You can get a toffee apple. You can get a bit of fish and chips. You know, it's just absolutely, it was a vast sort of landscape, which I just remember looking out and somebody saying, oh, there's the sea, like, you know, there in the distance, you know, like, and it was, but it's not like any beach that I know in Britain. You know, it's quite different from a lot of beaches because it's so big. But that left a very deep impression on me.
How far was that from where you grew up then?
Not far. I mean, I grew up between Bath and Bristol in a place called Keynsham, which is a little town. So I guess halfway between the two. And it's quite a sort of, you know, rural area. There's lots of, you know, country lanes and quaint little villages around there, which I used to explore on my bike. And I guess the whole area, the Mendip Hills, Somerset, the Somerset Levels, all around there. It's a rather beautiful countryside.
Yeah, it's a really picturesque area to grow up in.
It is, yeah. Very much so, yeah. And Bath, of course, is a beautiful old city.
Yep.
Where I went to school. So, I was surrounded by countryside. It was amazing growing up there because, you know, of course, now I appreciate it even more. But at the time, it was just like, that's where you went to school. Yeah. And, you know, we'd get the bus down into town, you know, and, you know, go to a cafe, have a cup of tea. But of course, I realise now we were surrounded by it, and you just become used to it. But I absolutely love it now. I go back there, and you know, I was there the other day, and you just took my dad out for dinner, and we were just, you know, walking along Victoria Park, through Victoria Park on a sort of warm evening. Went to the circus, the Royal Crescent. You know, it's just it's a beautiful city. It really is stunning.
Really is one for anyone who lives in the UK. If they're trying to discover some places that are on their doorstep, if they've not been, they have to go, right?
Oh, definitely.
So you were talking about going there to, that's where you went to school. Highly academic at school, multi-talented. But you went to university and you didn't last there very long. You dropped out. And did you then go traveling? Was it to go traveling?
Yes. I was supposed to do a course in English and drama. And the English part was at Westfield College in London University, and the drama was at Central. And I really very quickly realized very early on, you know, this wasn't for me. And I wanted to get out and I wanted to travel. I wanted to see the world. I wanted to work, find work, get a job. Just, you know, I was a kind of in a bit of a hurry, I guess. I was too restless. I was too impatient. And I now look back and think, well, 3 years just goes by in a flash these days. But then it seemed an age that was spreading out in front of me. So I was impatient to get out there and do things and work. And so with the reckless impetuosity of youth, I left. And then I did spend a while traveling. I drove, I had a little car, a little Citroen, one of those Dianes, which was like the kind of classic little sort of almost, you know, handmade car held together with, you know, safety pins.
Yeah.
It's literally just held together with pins. I mean, you could take the thing apart in a second. So we the four of us drove down. We drove all through France, down to the south of France, and sort of drove around there. And that was an amazing trip, and all the way down to Italy in the end.
Because your dad was a doctor, and your mum also was in the medical profession, and you know, I guess that's like quite a traditional, you know, path. So, given how talented you were across the board, were they kind of freaked out by your, you know, taking your own path?
Well, I think they were concerned. Yes, certainly. I mean, I think that they were really just worried that I would be able to find something that I liked doing and that I would be happy doing and that would be productive. But they were very supportive, and I think they realized that it was something that I wanted to do and needed to do. So they were sort of understanding of it. And I think what happened was, after I did a bit of traveling and all that, I did actually then go and do a technical course in stage management and understanding equipment. And so it was actually very, very useful, as it turned out, in the coming years, allowing me to be able to sort of do gigs and understand how to set up equipment and guitars,
like produce
and
your own show,
and do my own stuff. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, when or how did the comedy start for you?
I think the comedy it started when I was at school. Really.
Really.
I mean, there was us, me and a bunch of mates from school would put on a school review, an end of term review, where we just sort of, you know, write daft sketches and make fun of the teachers, and you know, that was basically the sort of, it's like a roast, you know.
Yeah.
And then after that, me and a mate from school, we'd sit around and record our own just daft ramblings, really, you know, make up sort of sketches. We'd do songs, and then actually I persuaded the owner of a club in Bath to put on a comedy club there. And they never had comedy on there. It was just like a nightclub. And he said, "Oh, all right, let's see how it goes." And that was the beginning of it all, really. And I guess I was 18 and 19, and
really young then.
Yeah,
yeah.
And you know, we put on this show. We didn't know what we were doing. I mean, it was probably a shambles, but there was something about it. There was something in it. There was like a spark in it where the audience and us were as one, just for a few moments, and that's all it takes. And you realize, that's it. That's how it should be. And then, you know, and that was it. And then once you get that, it's like touching a live wire. You know,
intoxicating.
It is. It's intoxicating. And then you realize, that's it. I'm hooked.
So that was the kind of this is it moment.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. And you know, we then set up a regular club, and it was like a basically a sort of a gong show, really. You know, so we actually did have a gong, and local acts would come on and then, you know, try out their stuff, and then the audience would say yeah or no, and then, you know, they'd be gonged off.
It was, that sounds so fun. I wish I was there. Quite brutal, I guess.
It was very gladiatorial, you know. Yeah. And that sort of that was great fun, a great learning experience. We did that for a while, and we got to meet lots of comics. And in fact, because there was very little in the way of comedy clubs then around the country, people would come up from London. People would come from all around. You know, it wasn't just Bath. They'd come from other cities and out in the country. Some people would come up from London just to get a gig. And so it was really at the kind of real birth of that, of the comedy scene in Britain.
How exciting that you're at the forefront of it.
Yeah, it was great fun.
So let's pause there for a second and move on to chapter two, which is the first place that you fell in love with.
Ah, well, when I was a bit older as a child, we would go on holidays to South Wales, and so it wasn't just this sort of vague notion of a place that had a beach and, you know, that I was. It was a definite destination. And when I got a bit older, me and my older cousins, so my uncles and aunts and extended family, we would all go to a place called Saundersfoot in mm-hmm. South Wales. Mm-hmm. And it was the place where my grandfather was from. So there was a strong family connection there. And we were just, I remember we stayed in a caravan, the old mob of us, great horde of us. And it was just like idyllic. I just remember endless days of like, running around the campsite, going to the beach, running into the caravan, getting a cold drink, running out again, and we'd go shrimping in pools, we'd go swimming in the sea. It was that time when, you know, when you're a kid and you get a bit older and you're here, where are we going on holiday? Are we going there? Oh, brilliant, you know, and yeah. it was like that sort of endless summer of the summer holiday, and that's what I associate with, and I loved it. And I've been back once or twice since, but I just remember I remember walking through a coastal path through a wood, and it was filled with wild garlic, and the smell was just overpowering. Sitting on the beach, sitting in the car in the rain,
because it would have been some rainy days too.
Yeah, there would have been rainy days. Yeah, eating bag of chips in a hot car with the condensation.
That's such a vivid memory.
Yeah, it's very pretty. I mean, it's like there's little coves and beaches, and there's sort of, you know, cliff top walks. Some of them are more open, so you're sort of, you know, you have like gorse and open coast, or you've got these, as I say, these little wooded areas and little paths running through it, and little fishing towns. And now, you know, I remember Saundersfoot Harbour. It was this beautiful harbour. And my grandfather telling me that when he was a kid, his father, that's where he taught him to swim. And he would say, right, this is how you're going to swim. And he'd go, go on, lad. And he would just chuck him in again. And I remember also you're seeing a basking shark swimming around there as well.
Yeah.
But yes, I've got a lot of great fondness for it. And in fact, when I started working as a comic, I remember I recorded one of my shows in Swansea, and I used to love going down there, the Mumbles and sort of West Wales. It's just, it's very pretty. So, got very fond memories of that.
So these kind of early shows developed into this combination of making people laugh and making music, that your signature style of comedy, which everyone has grown to, you know, love and adore. So what made you marry those two things?
I think the fact that I love both of them equally. I mean, when I was a kid, I learned a lot of instruments. I had an affinity to the piano, so I got piano lessons. I taught myself the guitar, and I thought that was what I was going to do. I thought music was going to be my life, and that's where I would end up in some form or other, some teaching or playing or whatever. And then I realized I loved listening to comedy albums. My cousin had a lot of albums by Monty Python, and my dad was a big fan of the Goons. And so I'd obviously hear comedy on the radio or on an album or a vinyl record. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I loved the way that it just somehow, it tickled your mind. You know, it's something about it which you want to hear more of. You want to hear like lateral thinking. You want to hear the other views of you know, and also basically, you know, grown-ups being silly when you're a kid is just hilarious. You know, you want to get more of it. And so I guess it's the fact that I realize I love the spoken word as much as music. And so that's why I guess I wanted to marry the two, because I think that, and I'm very fortunate in as much that I've been able to kind of use both of those things in what I do.
And you, as well as playing like the more conventional instruments like piano or guitar in your sets, you play a lot of, you know, weird and wonderful, wacky instruments as well. You're about to, you know, set back out on tour. Are there going to be some new instruments added to the show this time?
Yeah, well, I've got a few a few things that I've picked up. I've actually got this thing here. It's a Viking blowing horn, which I've picked up, and it's
what were the big actually, cone?
Yeah, I'll show you. Actually, I mean, I'll get it out for you. Hang on a sec. Oh, there you go. That's the sort of thing. You know, I don't know if you can see that.
Oh my goodness!
It's basically
it's a huge, like a tusk. It looks like
it is. It's actually the horn from a cow.
Oh,
so
wow.
It's an old one, and it's a beautiful thing, polished, and it makes this lovely sound. Hang on. Well, I'm practicing it, yet, but it's called a nyal horn, which is a blowing horn, and it was used to sort of, you know, like communicate over long distances. Yeah, I'll be trying to incorporate that.
So, speaking of falling in love, this chapter, a kind of a whole new swathe of people fell in love with you last year when you were taking part in Strictly Come Dancing, of which you rushed your way to victory there. I mean, it was like almost a foregone conclusion, I think, from about halfway through that this was going to happen. Now it's obviously on again. Are you watching this season?
Yes. Oh, yes, very much so. And I'm enjoying it. I think it's very, the standard is very, very high this year.
Isn't it?
There's some
it?
Brilliant dancers. Yeah. People are just turning in these terrific performances. There's these and wonderful partnerships. And now is the kind of time in the competition where the standard, it's getting a lot tougher for everyone, as I knew from my own experience, because what's happening is that people are now really starting to get it. They're really starting to kind of understand it and how to do the dances. But not only that, the partnerships are really kind of blossoming, you know, they're really gelling. And so there's this wonderful chemistry between people as they get more confident and they're able to turn in better performances. So it's fascinating to watch.
So who are you tipping?
Well,
who are you thinking you might get?
I don't know. It's difficult to say at this stage. I mean, the standard is so good. I think that in terms of the partnerships, John and Johannes have got this wonderful partnership.
Oh, they're so good, aren't they?
AJ and Kai and Rose and Giovanni. I mean, those are the ones at the moment seem to be leap out of me as the front runners. But who will eventually win it? I mean, it's difficult to say, really. They're all.
Isn't it incredible though, Rose to be turning in those kind of performances and not being able to hear the music? It's just
I think so, and I think that actually of all of them. You know, I mean, she's a terrific dancer. She's got great natural talent. But I think what she brings to it is this sort of, there's a kind of strength and a vulnerability, which has both of those things are sort of essential to dance, I think. And I think that what she's managed to do, and it's amazing. I was talking to her the other night, we're doing a TV show, and she was saying she has to count all the beats. So they start the routine and then she has to count in her head all the steps. I mean, which is amazing. So
it's just incredible. I guess for people who don't watch Strictly, we're talking about one of the contestants, Rose, who is deaf and yet is one of the best dancers in the mix.
That's
at the
right.
moment. Counting in her head the whole way through. It must require so much additional concentration.
Yes, I think so. And also, you know, just be able to do that and... You know, the thing about which I learned very quickly was that, you know, you have to perform these dances. You have to really inhabit it. You know, you have to sell it. You have to really give it so much drama and performance. because they're quite short. I mean, the routines are quite short. They're quite short and intense. And you have to, you know, you can't waste a second. You can't waste a beat. And you have to dance every single beat. You know, I'm now, just with the little that I know, I'm able to identify the better performances from the ones that aren't quite so good, because I know myself, having been in that situation, there's times when you're thinking, where am I? Where are we on? What is this bit? I don't know this bit. Ah! And you sort of tend to kind of panic a bit, and you know, and you start looking down at your feet, and you're like looking at your partner going, whoa, you know, and you have to try and stop that. You have to get over that. You have to kind of sail through it and just, you know, perform it with great confidence. And then you can actually cover up a lot of mistakes. You know what I mean? You can sort of, get away with a few little missteps if you've, you know, performed it with great drama.
Conviction.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
So Bill, just as a side note here, I'd read that you live basically with a menagerie of animals. What are we now hearing in the background?
Oh.
Are these chickens?
There's chickens, yes. Yeah, they're quite loud. Oh, yeah.
What are they doing? Hens. Are they being fed?
Yeah, no, that's right. Hens. Yeah, they're hens. I think now one of them's laying an egg. That's what that's all about. I'll close the door.
Okay, hold guys.
On. There we go.
Okay. Bye, heads. Well, so speaking of Strictly then, I wanted to ask you, of all the dances that you learnt, which would you like to dance in its home country?
Oh, I think, I mean, very much it'd be the tango in Argentina. Because it's such a lovely dance. It's a little softer and more sensual than the regular ballroom tango, which is very much, it's quite sort of angular and fierce, and there's lots of, you know, fast head movements. The Argentine is a little softer, it's a little bit more in hold, it's a bit more romantic. And there's all these wonderful sort of leg hooks, the ganchos, where your sort of legs intertwine with your partner. And I've seen when I knew we were going to be doing the Argentine, I was like, researched it a lot, watched a lot of it. And if you look, doesn't take much, and you realize in Buenos Aires, people dance the Argentine tango in the street. They're busking it, like buskers, you know, like we would see here on the tube playing, you know, the violin or the guitar. In Buenos Aires, there's people just dancing the tango, and, you know, they sort of put a hat. And then they'll just set up a dance floor and do a bit of tango, and people go, oh, great, and then put some money in a hat. I mean, that's just, it's wonderful. It's so part of the culture there. But what fascinates me about it is that, you know, it was how it began, which was like in the 1840s, when there was this huge wave of migration from Northern Europe to South America. It was this sort of seen as this land of opportunity. And it was just thousands and thousands, mainly men, who were flocked to places like Buenos Aires looking for work. It was this new, there was, you know, encouragement, people to come there. It was a new country. They wanted people to come and help build the country. And, of course, you know, at night there was nothing for them to do, so they started dancing. And there was all these different influences from Europe. There was, you know, it was the polka. There was that, you know, that came over. There was, you know, waltz, there were waltz, the polka, all these European dances sort of melded with all of these, the South American influence, and created this extremely wonderful sort of, you know, sensual dance, which actually was danced with men. Men would dance with other men. That was perfectly common. And just so to go there and dance it in the street, I would love that.
I'd love to see it.
Yeah.
New series?
Let's do it. Bill Bailey goes around the world dancing the local dances.
Yep, I think so. Let's do it. Let's do it.
Okay.
Yep. I'm there. Ready. I'll come with you.
Namaskaram. My name is Mayad. I'm a tour leader with Explore. Come, follow me for a breakfast you will never forget. Namaste. Because you are going to make an incredible masala dosa under the watchful eye of my mom. Kya baat hai, mom. Each home adds their special touches. But not everyone gets to join in a traditional family meal. You will if you explore. For global adventures, search exploreworldwide.com. And don't just travel, explore.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb. So chapter three is the place where you learn the most about yourself.
Yes. Well, now this, actually, I did think about this for a while, and I was interesting that brief, you know, the moat where you learn about yourself, because these are not necessarily good experiences, I don't think.
No, yeah.
You know, I think that actually sometimes when you find yourself traveling and things don't go well, it's how you deal with them that then, you know, these experiences are character forming and you find a bit of resilience. And I think the one that really stands out for me was when I traveled to meet some friends in France for a holiday, and a bunch of school friends and other people, and we camped and we went all around France, and then they all left and I stayed on my own because I had another week of holiday. So I went busking in the south of France, and I sort of camped, and then I ended up in Marseille, and I don't know why I ended up there. I think it's because my train home was from Marseille. And so I arrived there, yeah, and I didn't know the city. And I don't know if you've been to Marseille, but it's quite intimidating. It's quite a gritty sort of, you know, port city. It gives off an atmosphere of, it's quite sort of, you know, you have to be street savvy. And I ended up in this, I didn't know what I was doing. I got on a bus, and of course you're supposed to buy a ticket before you get on the bus. And I just got on the bus, and then a cop came over and basically I thought I was going to be arrested. And he's like, no, you have to buy this ticket. They're all right. Okay. And then I ended up with my backpack and my guitar at a campsite. And I said, well, where do I camp? And I was at the Camping Municipal, right? I don't know if you've ever been to Camping Municipal. It is not the most luxurious of all campsites. It was in the town. It was in Marseille, in the sort of urban environment. So there's no grass. It's gravel. So that literally you had to sort of bang your tent pegs into gravel. And it was so grim. And I didn't have a hammer. Because I've been camping in sites where, you know, you just push the tent pegs into soft earth. That's fine. So I remember it was cold and it was drizzling, and I was trying to get the flapping tent up, and I couldn't get the tent pegs into the gravel. And I just I was almost at my wit's end. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, I think I might just, you know what I mean? You just want to sit down and just cry and just think, to hell with it. Yeah. And a French guy came over, and I always remember he said to me, "Vous n'avez pas de marteau," you know, which is you don't have a hammer, you know, so you don't have a mallet, like, you know, you're English, you don't come prepared. And I went, "You don't have a mallet," and I went, no, and I was like slightly tearful, no, and he went, "Oh, you can have mine," and then he lent me this mallet, and I managed to get the tent up, and I sort of like pulled it together, and I realised. Yeah, that was I was a long way, you know, I was still young. I was only like 18 or something, you know, and I was a little bit sort of homesick, away from home, on my own, wasn't prepared. I was sort of low. And yet somehow you find the resolve to kind of get up in the morning, pack the tent away, get in the bag, get on the train, you know. And it was like a real moment of like, yeah, I got through that. Yeah. And it sort of gives you an enormous amount of confidence.
Yeah. And then I guess kind of from that point onwards, you've been traveling, I imagine, on your own quite a lot, like nonstop touring around the world. Your fan base is very much global.
Yeah.
So you've seen so much of the world. Chapter 4 is your all-time favorite destination. Like, when reflecting on all the places that you've been, which comes to mind?
Well, I think it would have to be Indonesia. Because somewhere that we've travelled to a lot over the years, nearly 25 years we've been travelling there now, and it's somewhere which I really sort of fell in love with when I went there with my wife. We went married at the time. We got married there. So I guess that's why I have a sort of strong connection with the place. And the fact we've met lots of friends there, we've spent a lot of time there. We explored up and down the archipelago, gone to the remotest parts, the wildest parts. And it's just stunningly beautiful, incredibly varied. The people are so friendly. That everything about it is a richness, a profusion. The food has become our sort of favorite cuisine, and some of the experiences we've had there have just been quite unique, you know, rafting and swollen rivers through forests, seeing incredible bird life, spending the time at the tops of trees in canopies, watching, you know, flocks of cockatoos on the island of Seram, swimming with dolphins, seeing whales, I mean, climbing to the tops of mountains, seeing active volcanoes. I mean, it's just a place of extremes many times, and a place of great volatility. You know, it's the ring of fire. You know, the whole archipelago is on this sort of very geologically active, you know, part of the world. So there's a lot of, as I say, a lot of volcanoes, but there's a lot of beautiful islands and lots of incredible change as well, incredible diversity in terms of like how people look, how the food is, how the architecture is, what the experiences you can have. And it's quite chaotic as well. I mean, it's, you know, it's a place, you know, if you like to keep to time and you've got a schedule, then I wouldn't recommend it going there. But if you want to go with the flow, if you want to let life just take you along, if you want to immerse yourself in a completely different culture and a different world, really, then that's the place.
A lot of people think Indonesia, they just think like Bali, right? So you've explored way beyond Bali.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
For people who maybe want to, you know, get a taste of something beyond Bali, where would you tell them to go?
Oh, very much. I mean, I would say, you know, for us, when we go back now, we sometimes don't even go to Bali. We'll go to Jakarta first. And that's the kind of hub from where you can discover all sorts of other places. But yes, I mean, I would say not far from Bali, you have Komodo, you have the islands of Nusa Tenggara, Flores, Sumbawa, Sumba. These islands are not so touristy, not so developed, but stunningly beautiful. I would say, you know, Sumatra. You know, Sumatra, huge, a vast island with incredible wildlife, amazing food, amazing people, history, wonderful temples. Mm. And in fact, the island of Java as well is just is stunningly beautiful as well. But yeah, I mean, there's Indonesian Borneo, Kalimantan, there's Sulawesi, which used to be Celebes, which has these, you know, it's like Bali was like 40, 50 years ago. Huge amounts of, you know, agriculture in the mountains. So like you've got these terraced rice paddies, you've got these beautiful mountains, huge areas of national park, traditional, the long houses with these amazing sort of lifted gables. And then if you go further east, you get to places like Halmahera, which is again, right out there, but amazing wildlife. And Ternate is the sort of center of the, one of the centers of the spice trade. It's the sort of place where cinnamon was and clove was cultivated. And it has a sultan, you know. And then you go that further east to the Eastern Moluccas, which was the center, the hub, the beating heart of the kind of the Dutch East Indies Company, where they sort of harvested spice, sent it back. And it was when spice was more valuable than gold. So there's remnants of the Portuguese and the Spanish and the British colonial legacy, little islands, tiny little gems, green gems, volcanoes, reefs, crystal clear water, people who are friendly, they're delighted that you've showed up there. And then you go further east to Papua, West Papua, which is the Indonesian half of Papua New Guinea, which is, again, completely different. There's, you know, there's tribes still living in the forests, living very traditionally. There's, again, huge unspoiled swathes of forest. And so it's
my goodness, I mean, what a lot to discover.
There's a huge amount to discover. Yeah, Bali's just a tiny, tiny bit of it.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's really given me the wanderlust this morning.
Yeah.
Well, you're talking about gems. Chapter 5 is your hidden gem, a place that you really love that my listeners wouldn't know so much about. Where would you pick for that?
Well, do you know what? I was thinking about this yesterday. I walked up to Ivanhoe Beacon, which is near Tring in Hertfordshire, and I walked a section of the Ridgeway, and it occurred to me that whilst this is right in the heart of southern England, surrounded by towns and villages and, you know, very well-to-do, tidy, you know, gardens and farms, it's not really that well-known, and people don't really realise how remote it is. And to me, it is one of the hidden gems of Britain. Certainly, it's accessible for me because I live in London, but it's a national trail. It runs from Ivanhoe Beacon all the way down to Aylesbury. It goes past Aylesbury. It goes to Avebury Stone Circle in Wiltshire, and it's about 90 miles long.
90 miles.
And I've walked it a couple of times now, and it's every time I get on it, I'm struck by how remote it feels. Like, you know, you're walking along, sometimes you don't see anyone. Sometimes you don't, you know, you don't hear traffic. You're not really under a flight path. There's no reminders of the modern world. You're just walking across, you know, chalk upland, and then you're in forest. It's absolutely stunning. As soon as you're looking at kestrels, red kite, deer, incredible amounts of butterflies. I still saw some butterflies this late on in the year.
Wow.
And it's the oldest road in Britain. In Europe. It's 5,000 years old. And it used to run from Lyme Regis all the way to Cromer in East Anglia. And it was a trade route. It was a kind of, it connected up. And people used to drive sheep along it. Roman centurions used to walk along it. It was a very significant kind of trade path that connected the south to the east coast. And there's sections of it, the Ridgeway, the only surviving section is this one now. But it struck me yesterday. I thought, this is a real gem. And it's right there. You know,
What a great hidden gem. Thank you so much. I really look forward to discovering that. Well, in contrast to that, chapter 6, the penultimate chapter, is your worst travel experience or the place that you would never go back to?
Well, it's an interesting one because, again, I thought about this for a while. And actually, I'd have to say it was Barbados, right? And the thing, the reason for that was that it was, we needed somewhere, we wanted somewhere warm to go years ago when our son was very little. And we looked at all these different places and we thought, well, everyone goes to the Caribbean. We're not really that sort of people. We, you know, we prefer out-of-the-way places, non-touristy places. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he was little. We only had a few days. You know, it's 8 hours rather than long haul across the world. So we'll try that. And I've got to say, it was I just couldn't see it. I don't understand why people go and rave about it. We couldn't find anything decent to eat. That was the first thing. You know, mm-hmm. we were there's tourists everywhere and there's people like on deck chairs reading the Daily Telegraph. And I'm thinking, oh, no, this is not why I want from getting away. I mean, he loved it, you know, and he was little. I mean, he was four or something, you know, so he liked going in the sea. It was warm. The sand was clean. That was fine. The beaches were nice. Great. That was from that level. It was fine. But from us now, I think, as you know, and he would be the same. You know, he'd say he wants somewhere where there's a bit of interest. I'd rather go somewhere where there was decent food or interesting, you know, thing that we couldn't find any. We ended up going to a Chinese restaurant.
No way, really?
Because all the food gets imported from America.
Yeah.
So it just comes in and gets put in the freezer. And so if you're foodies, if you like the authentic stuff, which is just literally going to a street stall like in Ambon, say, in Eastern Moluccas, and getting a bowl of rujak, which is fresh fruit and veg carved up with peanut sauce and chili. That is one of the most delicious things I've ever eaten.
Yeah.
And I was craving that. And I was like, I want spice. I want something like that. And I don't know, perhaps we were going to the wrong places. Perhaps I'll give it another go one day. We just had a bad experience, but that was...
Looking for more authenticity.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you a foodie?
Very much so, yes. Yeah, and we love, you know, all kinds of, mainly Asian food, I got to say, because we love Indonesia so much. So we like lots of Thai, Laotian, Cambodian, you know, Vietnamese, that's our go-to favourite food. But... Oh, I mean, I love all sorts of stuff. I mean, I'm a big fan of tapas. I love to go to Spain for that very reason, mm-hmm. you know. But I just like that way of eating, you know, just little small plates.
Picky bits.
Yeah, exactly.
So before we wrap up your Travel Diaries, Bill, are there any other destinations that you'd like to give a shout out to?
Any destinations? I mean, I love Iceland. I mean, I've talked about that being in Spain. But just before lockdown, I went there with... my son and my friend Sean and his daughter, and we went to a place in the Pyrenees we'd never been to before, Baquera, mm-hmm. Baquera Beret, which was absolutely beautiful, and it was the people were very friendly, the food was great. It was a little bit of a hidden gem. It was one of those places that a lot of the Spanish people go to, but not many Brits. So I love that. Sitges, I very much love, just outside Barcelona, and Barcelona particularly as well. I love Spain. I did a gig there recently. That was just before lockdown again, which was great. Hired bikes and we went all cycling around there. And there's a wonderful place up in the north, north of Barcelona, which I would definitely recommend if you want something a bit different. It's I think it's like an 11th century monastery in a place called Bigues y Riells. And it's like built into the cliff. And it's a kind of walk up through this valley to get to it. It's like a kind of pilgrimage. And you walk through orchards and you see rainbow bee eaters. And that was an amazing experience.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Do you learn a lot about a destination by performing there?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, I think that's why I've always loved. I mean, I think I was, you know, one of the reasons I always will choose to perform in a place is because I want to know more about it. I think you get a handle on a place, you get to know lots of local people, you get to know how a place works and gets how it ticks. You get under the skin of a place a little bit with that. A few years ago, I'd be asked to tour the Highlands and Islands of Scotland because it's somewhere I'd not been to or spent much time, but I wanted to really explore it. And so I went all around Shetland and Orkney and the Outer Hebrides and, you know, Skye and Uist and, you know, Harris and Lewis and all those kind of places because I just wanted to experience it. And by doing a show there, then, yes, you have to get to know about it. You have to know about ferry times and how you get from place A to B and, you know, what's the – what goes on here? What's the business? How does – you know, what's the main source of income? How do people make a living here? You know, and you very quickly get a kind of snapshot of a place, very – probably more in a way that you wouldn't do just if you were a tourist.
Yeah, exactly. I like the idea of also picking where you're going to perform in terms of places that you want to
yes.
discover.
Yeah,
that's quite a luxury.
Yeah.
So thinking about that then, Chapter 7 is the destination at the top of your travel bucket list. Is that somewhere you're going to do a gig in the future or somewhere that you do a family holiday? Where are you keen to get to?
There's a few really. I don't quite know which one to pick. I mean...
let's have all of them.
I have all of them. Okay. Well, then I'd say the three places that I haven't been and I would love to go. Patagonia be the first one, just because of the how it looks, the beauty, the wildness of it, just how stunning it is, and also it means I get to go to Argentina, so I'd be able to do the tango. So that's that.
Perfect.
Then Namibia would be the next place because. I actually just got a text from a friend I made when I made a TV show in Cape Town about baboons, and we ran out of time. We couldn't, but he said, "Oh, you have to go to Namibia. It's just amazing. You know, it's this beautiful desert. This like, you know, this lions on the beach." And I was like, "What? This I have to see."
Yeah.
And so just that image has been in my head ever since. So that's my next one, and. The final one would be a little bit unusual, a bit off the beaten track, would be the Kamchatka Peninsula, which is this long peninsula. It's a sort of finger of land that comes down right in the eastern part of Russia, sort of almost from Siberia. And it's it was a sort of port. It was a jumping off point for the Peter the Great, the Tsar of Russia, his expeditions across to Alaska. And there's a fantastic story of a German botanist called George Steller who joined one of these. And it's an amazing story of how he discovered Alaska. He was the first European to set foot there. It's a great place of adventure, but also it's a place of amazing wildness, extremely beautiful forests and rushing rivers and snow-capped mountains, and also the home to the world's largest owl, which is the Blakiston's fish owl, which, of course, as you probably knew that. And,
because you're into birds.
I love birds, you see. Yeah. I'm into my birds. And so often sometimes knowing that there's a bird in a place will be a reason to go there. And so that to me is good enough reason to go somewhere, to see the world's largest owl. I mean,
I'd
beat a path to that place in a minute.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Bill Bailey. Those were your travel diaries. It has been an absolute joy to talk to you this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, I loved speaking to Bill. Bill Bailey's En Route to Normal tour kicks off in Plymouth on Sunday the 12th of December and runs through to mid-January. All the tickets and dates can be found at www.billbailey.co.uk. Thanks so much for listening today. If you are enjoying the podcast, then don't forget to hit subscribe, or if you use Apple Podcasts, to hit follow so that a new episode lands in your podcast app each week. And if you really enjoyed it, then if you fancy leaving a rating or a review, that would be extra special. If you want to find out who's joining me on next week's episode, come and follow me on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubenstein. Would love to hear from you, as always. And if you can't wait till then, remember there's all of the first 5 seasons to catch up on, nearly 70 episodes to keep you busy there. And don't forget that all the destinations mentioned by my guests I always include in the episode show notes, and they're also always on my website, thetraveldiariespodcast.com. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll be back next week. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.